Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber was sent to work at the IHS facility in Pine Ridge after gaining an ugly and suspicious reputation at his previous IHS medical position in Browning, Montana, on the Blackfeet Reservation. By the time he arrived in South Dakota, he had already been accused of sexually molesting multiple Native American boys. Now, a new Frontline and Wall Street Journal investigation explores the case against Dr. Weber and uncovers the decades-long failure to stop the government doctor from preying on the young men in his care. You can watch Frontline's Predator on the Reservation tonight on SDPB-TV. That's at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. Wall Street Journal reporter and Frontline correspondent Christopher Weaver joins us today. He was part of a journalism team that won a 2015 Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. In addition to reporting, he also teaches at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and he joins us now on the phone. Christopher Weaver, thanks for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is such a difficult story that brings out a lot of emotions, a lot of anger, a lot of shame, a lot of regret from people. And I'm wondering, as you go back to, you know, when did the Wall Street Journal sort of, you know, when did you as a journalist first hear about this story and start investigating it?
Yeah, well, we came to it, you know, myself and my colleague, Dan Frosch, who, you know, we've worked sort of in lockstep throughout our more than 2 years covering the Indian Health Service. And we, you know, we came to it as sort of a, how to say, like a government watchdog sort of story where we were, you know, as I'm sure you, you know, followed there, we became aware that some of the hospitals in the Indian Health Service's Great Plains area were struggling and in some cases just failing to meet the federal government's own regulatory requirements for what a hospital needs to be able to do to stay open. And we wanted to know why, you know, why that was. And we spent a good amount of time reporting about it. And one of the things that it led us to was the staffing issues that are endemic in the Indian Health Service, and particularly in some areas in your neck of the woods. And one of the things we quickly realized was that the agency was sort of between a rock and a hard place, where they were hiring doctors that even their own bureaucrats had suspicions about because of the incredible need to fill slots at hospitals where it was hard to find medical providers to work.
I want to go back to around 1992, the early 90s in Blackfeet Reservation. And this is when Dr. Weber sort of arrives for the first time. What are some of their first impressions of him as a doctor?
Yeah, well, when, you know, so my colleague Dan did a lot of reporting there. And one of the things that he learned from the former CEO of the Blackfeet Hospital was that when Dr. Weber first showed up there, you know, he was already in the IHS. He'd been in Oklahoma and had done some academic training at a hospital in New Mexico. And when he first arrived at Blackfeet, he was a welcome relief because, as the CEO, you know, told us, they had been without a pediatrician for some time. And, you know, it's obvious that you would need to have a pediatrician around if you're going to run an effective hospital. So it was like a breath of fresh air in that regard. And, you know, he came, he was going to fill a really important need. He seemed to want to engage with the community. And at first, everybody was pretty happy to have him.
Yeah. How long before people get suspicious about the particular way in which he's engaging in the community and the particular people that he's engaging with?
Yeah, not long. This guy, Tim Davis, who is now the chairman of the Blackfeet tribe, recalled that, you know, in the mid-90s when he was a facilities manager at the IHS hospital on that reservation, you know, doing inspections of Dr. Weber's house at the time and seeing that he was sort of stockpiling stuff for kids despite being, you know, a guy with no family, and thought that was suspicious and reported it. And, you know, people seemed to think that, yes, that was perhaps unusual, but maybe not, you know, cause for any major concern. But from there, things just escalated.
Yeah, he's got lots of stuff. You know, he's got sodas and candy and video games and toys. And this Tim Davis, or Running Weasel, says, you know, I buy stuff for my kids, but this was a lot of stuff for a lot of different kids.
Yeah, this is a guy who says he has eight kids.
Yeah, right? Now, Dr. Stanley is grooming not only the boys, that he is preying on, but he's grooming the entire community by creating this persona of a person who's seen with kids and seen helping out and seen in the community. Talk a little bit about sort of how he groomed a community as well as individual children.
Yeah, it's a pattern of behavior noticed by some mental health providers at that facility, which was that, you know, he'd take kids on trips, sometimes overnight trips, you know, to restaurants, things like that, where he and the young boys, you know, between age maybe 10 and 15, would be seen together in public. And, you know, one psychologist described that as grooming behavior, that, you know, basically he was looking to sort of normalize his contact and relationship with the children on the reservation and, you know, identify those who were perhaps coming from kind of less supportive backgrounds.
Is he reported at all? Is he confronted at all in Montana with the other doctors who are around him, with the authorities? Who sort of has the first inkling that something needs to be done?
Yeah, well, the psychologist we're talking about is a guy named Dan Foster, a longtime Indian Health Service provider, says that he confronted Dr. Weber and, you know, said that, you know, what's going on here, basically, and that Dr. Weber assured him that nothing was happening and then made himself scarce. Basically, the two men didn't run into each other subsequent to that, and Dr. Foster's telling. But that wasn't, you know, really the end of it. I mean, there were complaints. There was an incident in which Dr. Weber was beat up. There was a relative who complained about a child spending the night at Dr. Weber's house. And that's what really led to sort of the final showdown over Dr. Weber and Browning.
All right. So tell us a little bit about that final showdown. And then the great mystery that is so frustrating. How does he end up in Pine Ridge after everything? They're using the word pedophile at this point. They're using, now it's in retrospect that they're being interviewed. But even at that time, they know what's going on. And yet he ends up in Pine Ridge.
Right. So the clinical director, this is the top doctor, the most senior ranking doctor at the hospital in Browning, the guy who oversees the whole medical staff, described being summoned to the Indian Health Service's regional headquarters in Billings, Montana, and told by the guy who ran that office at the time that he was convinced Dr. Weber was a pedophile following the complaints that we just discussed, and he had to go. So the clinical director, a physician named Randy Rottenbiller, still lives on the edge of the Blackfeet Reservation out there and, you know, spent his whole career working there, goes back to Browning, confronts Dr. Weber, tells him, look, you have to go, and recalls that he essentially left, you know, almost immediately. And from the Browning perspective, that was the end of that. But the Indian Health Service didn't fire him, and they didn't, as far as we can document, really do any kind of an investigation. You know, instead what happened is they transferred him. And exactly who pulled the trigger on that decision, exactly what the bureaucratic mechanics of that were, are still not clear to us after all these many months of reporting. But what is clear is that in May of 1995, Dr. Weber was treating kids in the Blackfeet Reservation. And by June of 1995, he was treating kids at another IHS hospital on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
All right, complaints start propping up in Pine Ridge pretty quickly. Within months, people are complaining about his behavior, not because of what they know from Montana, but because of his behavior in South Dakota.
Right. What happened is that by December of 1995, a parent had complained about a kid who had seen Dr. Weber, basically because he had a cold, cough and cold. And in the course of examining this patient, apparently Dr. Weber had done some kind of an exam based on the recollections of people who were, you know, in the agency at the time, now, you know, more than 20 years ago. But Dr. Weber had done some kind of an exam that the parents seemed to think was, like, not appropriate to the reason the kid had been brought in. And the agency started looking into this. They referred the matter to law enforcement. There was an FBI investigation looking into whether Dr. Weber had, quote, over-examined this patient. And according to some court records, you know, from many years later, it appeared that the clinical director of the hospital, of the Pine Ridge Hospital, was concerned that the physician had done a genital exam of this kid who had just been brought in for cold symptoms and that it was suspicious. But the FBI did not substantiate, you know, whatever the complaint was. No charges were brought. And, you know, during this investigation, Dr. Weber had been removed to administrative duties. Nothing came of it, and he went back to work. And, you know, years and years passed.
I want to talk about some of the boys that were in his care, some of the now men who have spoken out against him. And again, you know, a note to our listeners, this is tough stuff, and some of it gets into some detail here that you might want to prepare yourself for. But the community kind of knows who the Weber boys are. He hires people to work in his garden. He kind of continues this continued grooming behavior that he has. And tell me about Paul. And let's start with the fact that Paul, at the time that the journalists are interviewing him, he's in prison. You have to get a hold of him behind bars. So tell me about Paul's story, please.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to just step back to set that up for a second, you know, we've interviewed a number of Dr. Weber's victims, and, you know, they all are either in or have been sort of in and out of incarceration, and you know, that just seems to be part of the nexus of, you know, who's talking about this, or perhaps just who Dr. Weber victimized or allegedly victimized. And this guy, you know, Paul, is a, you know, particularly sort of difficult case, because the story that he tells goes all the way back to his childhood in the exam rooms of the IHS hospital, where Dr. Weber, according to him, you know, began this sort of escalating pattern of, you know, petting and molestation that, you know, rose to sexual assault and ultimately, you know, coerced sex, where, you know, he would get money or prescription drugs in exchange for sexual favors as a young teenager. And, you know, that went on for many years. And I think, you know, what Paul's role in the story is that eventually, you know, as he got older, he kind of turned the tables in a way and, you know, wound up assaulting Dr. Weber on at least a couple of occasions, which triggered a series of events that, you know, over the course of a decade, sort of wound up bringing the house down around this whole case.
Yeah, and let's start with one of the early ones where he ends up hiding. There's a physical confrontation. Paul is sort of, he pushes back, literally and figuratively, says, "This is disgusting to me," you know, runs out and hides. The tribal police come and find him, and it's a tribal police officer who says, "Hey, are you okay?" And Paul says, "Yeah, that was the first time that anybody had asked me that." And I think a lot of people in South Dakota understand the legal limitations and the ramifications of, the federal law and tribal police. But explain to people who might not understand, why isn't that tribal police officer able to really do anything that meaningfully helps Paul at that point, when Paul tells him what's been going on with Dr. Weber?
Yeah, so there's this jurisdictional issue that kind of lies at the heart of that conflict. And what happened between, you know, Paul and Dr. Weber and this tribal police officer is that, you know, Dr. Weber had called the police, right? What happened is there was an altercation between Paul and Dr. Weber at Dr. Weber's house. And that ended with Dr. Weber being sort of pushed over and his wallet stolen. So he called the police. And they ended up finding Paul and, you know, in this moment, identifying him as the perp in this situation, right, and not the victim, hiding out in a laundry room of a nearby kind of retirement facility, a senior home, senior living quarters, I guess you would call it. And they arrested him. And in the course of the arrest, he began sort of making these allegations about Dr. Weber that, you know, that they were engaged in this sort of in this inappropriate relationship. And the tribal policeman, a retired cop named Dan Hudspeth, started to look at it, you know, thinking, well, maybe this guy is not just the perp, but the victim too. Except for Officer Hudspeth couldn't really pursue that in any kind of meaningful way because the tribe isn't able to prosecute through its own justice system offenders who are not themselves tribal members. This is under, you know, federal law that basically gives federal U.S. government authorities jurisdiction over non-tribal members who commit crimes on reservations and over certain major crimes, no matter who's committed them. So by almost any measure, you know, it was beyond the tribe's jurisdictional authority to really do anything about this besides refer it to the feds, if in fact Paul's allegations at that time were true. So that's what Officer Hudspeth says they did. They sent it to the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs criminal investigators, who, when I spoke to them, either declined to comment or did not respond to our request for comment. This would have been sometime in the early 2000s. Mm.
Paul says that the other nurses and doctors knew something was up. When he leaves the exam room of Dr. Weber, they give him that look, and he says they know, and I know, everyone knows. Do any of Dr. Weber's colleagues in Pine Ridge have a sense and begin to confront him, similar to some of the conversations he had in Montana?
Yeah, so this, you know, a number of them do, including the guy who for many years was the chief executive officer of the Pine Ridge IHS Hospital, a man named Bill Puyer, who, you know, left that job in 2011, retired from the agency in 2012, but who oversaw the facility during, you know, a good chunk of the time that Dr. Weber was working there. And after the incident where Dr. Weber was assaulted, you know, Mr. Puyer said he developed his own suspicions about what might be going on with Dr. Weber and had heard the gossip and in some cases even talked to some of the boys who were assaulted. But as he says, and, you know, as Paul has told us about his conversation with Mr. Puyer, he didn't say anything. You know, he said we were just going up there to get some money. And, you know, I mean, some of that, I think, speaks to the difficulty of trying to investigate or find witnesses or victims in cases where young men are sexually assaulted.
Mm. And yet when people are asked as part of, you know, for you or your colleagues, when you ask, you know, Dan Foster, for example, about, you know, could you have done more? Dan Foster, the psychiatrist from Montana, breaks down pretty hard. I mean, people are having now a difficult time processing what had happened and what they did or didn't do to stop it. This is an emotional story. What was it like to sort of be in the room with some of those people as they processed the scope of Dr. Weber's victimization of these children?
Well, you know, a lot of these conversations kind of span the spectrum from the sort of resigned frustration and maybe even a conviction that there was nothing more, you know, any individual bureaucrat could have done, to perhaps a recognition, you know, that in fact that's completely wrong and that there was a whole lot of people could have done differently to put an end to this far, far sooner. You know, and that's where you see these breakdowns, you know, and I mean, it wasn't just, you know, Dr. Foster, quite a few people that we interviewed, including the guy who is now the acting director of the whole Indian Health Service.
Yeah.
You know, confronted these really emotional moments when they began to realize, you know, maybe not that even what that they were at fault, but just where the opportunities were to have done something different or to do something different now to ensure it doesn't happen again.
Mm. As a journalist, when you hear them sort of come to that realization, and here I think I'm going to play a clip now, and this
sure.
is the former IHS director, someone who was a director of IHS twice. His name is Bob McSwain, and this is a part where he's being asked, you know, how could this even happen? How could somebody with this kind of record continue to be at IHS? I'll ask you about it in a minute, but first, here's what he had to say.
It goes back to the very heart of they needed his skills. And so they moved him around to maintain his contribution. It's fair to say that because of the absolute need to fill positions, we don't really get the best of the best.
And this seems like a world-class understatement. And he goes on to talk about doctors who womanize, and you know, but he shows up and he sees patients. But this is a pedophile. This is somebody who's doing the opposite of caring for these kids. I know how I felt when I heard those words just watching it on a screen. How did you as reporters feel in the team when you come back with revelations like that about...
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of an amazing admission from a man who is one of the most senior and, you know, experienced leaders that the Indian Health Service has, you know, has had in recent years. And, you know, I have some sort of sympathy for the predicament that the agency's leaders have been in and currently find themselves in, which is that they need to find staff to keep hospitals open. And it can be difficult in some circumstances. But that, you know, what Mr. McSwain described as a strange tolerance, you know, it seems to be a real vulnerability for the agency and for the patients that it's meant to serve and protect. And, you know, it's hard to see how that could be acceptable. And, you know, in talking to the current agency director, you know, he says that it's not. I don't know, you know, whether they will find, though, you know, a source of the medical professionals that they need that have the, you know, the credentials and you know, track records that really they should be insisting on.
We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about how all this starts to come crashing down, and it's really the courage of some people like Paul who are willing to come forward. So we're talking with Christopher Weaver, Wall Street Journal reporter and frontline correspondent. The program is Predator on the Reservation. It's tonight on SDPB-TV, 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guest is Christopher Weaver. He's a Wall Street Journal reporter and frontline correspondent, and we're talking today about Frontline's Predator on the Reservation. It's a new documentary investigation. You can see it on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Television. That's tonight at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. Many South Dakota people appear in this documentary, and I'm wondering, Christopher, we could start with Elaine Yellowhorse and how this sort of this investigation into Dr. Stanley Patrick Weber begins to finally get some traction where we might see an actual indictment. How does it begin?
Right. So Elaine is a young woman from Wounded Knee. She, you know, grew up there on the reservation and had heard rumors, you know, in her early adulthood about Dr. Weber and the allegations against him and the incident in which he was assaulted at his house by, you know, three young Lakota men. And, you know, kind of stored those away in the back of her mind. And years later, she, starting in 2014, became a prosecutor for the Oglala Sioux Tribe. Working for the Attorney General at that time, Tatewi Means. And Elaine Yellowhorse was, as she describes it, driving to work one day, contemplating a different sexual assault case that she had prosecuted, and remembered the, you know, the rumors she'd heard some years earlier about Dr. Weber and the incident when he was beat up. And she thought, well, I wonder, you know, whatever happened to that doctor. So she tells a story that she gets to work, you know, talks to Ms. Means, her boss, and they agree that, you know, sure, she'll look into it a little bit. You know, they know that, you know, like we talked about with the jurisdictional issues, that there's some limits to what the tribe can do in terms of prosecuting, but there's no reason they can't ask some questions. So she starts doing that, and within a few weeks identifies somebody who is claiming to her that the young men who beat up Dr. Weber, you know, talked to her after the incident, and one of them at least had explained that he had done it in part because he'd been sexually assaulted over years by Dr. Weber. And she gives Elaine that name, and it's Paul.
And this is, I want to get at this idea of, first of all, how invisible these kids are in the first place. Right? In the sense that there's something happening, there's this big structural overarching deficiency in IHS, but then there's also this invisibility of these children who he is preying on specifically because they are vulnerable. and because they are poor and because maybe their parents aren't, you know, although some parents are reporting, Dr. Weber, other kids don't have a relationship with their parents in the same way that others do. But I also want to get this idea of how hard it is for these boys to come forward. And Elaine mentions this. She's like, you know, it's even harder to get them as victims of sexual assault to tell the details of their story.
Yeah, I mean, it was really difficult, I think, for many of these young men to ever, you know, get around to speaking up. And I think it's not, you know, a total coincidence that, you know, it's happened finally now, as many of them are much older and have put kind of a lot of distance between, you know, what happened to them as boys and, you know, where they've wound up now as men. And I think even in the sort of aftermath of a number of them coming forward, you know, only then have they perhaps begun to make the link, right, the association between what happened to them in the exam rooms of the Indian Health Service Hospital on Pine Ridge or at Dr. Weber's house with what ended up being their fates, which in many cases has been, you know, a kind of endless string of incarcerations and addiction. And, you know, I even now, right, it's been even on this witness stand and, you know, his federal trial in Montana, the kids that were, you know, telling these stories were telling it through, you know, through just like walls of pain.
They're described as sort of these, you know, these tough men who then become little boys on the stand as they are, you know, telling the story. They're remembering who they were as children, and it's a difficult thing to go through. And then yet, we see Dr. Weber outside the courthouse in Montana, smiling and laughing and saying, "Hey, it's a sunny day today." Let's talk about him a little bit. He is continuously slippery as far as confrontation. He is willing to, you know, deny allegations and fight the allegations. What do we know about him and how he is speaking out about the allegations?
Right. So he, you know, he has not responded to our requests for comment. You know, if you watch our film about this sad story, you know, you'll hear him talking, but he never talked to us. You know, he right. was interviewed by law enforcement in this investigation, this federal investigation that was that resulted from Elaine Yellowhorse and, you know, her boss passing on the information that there was a potential victim who, you know, potentially would talk. And, you know, that investigation led to these two detectives, one guy from the HHS Office of Inspector General and the BIA Special Agent, interviewing Dr. Weber at his house. And, you know, he denied all of the allegations or claimed not to remember, you know, what they were asking him about. But at that point, you know, the detectives, you know, had brought with them things like hotel receipts and things that backed up some of the victim's stories. So they were, well prepared for this interview. You know, even after that, you know, indictments were brought in South Dakota and eventually Montana as the investigation expanded. And Dr. Weber, you know, has continued to deny the charges. He is now appealing a conviction in Montana and, you know, did not make any statement when offered the opportunity, you know, at that conviction by the judge.
Hmm. Trial set in South Dakota in September, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's been rescheduled a number of times. He was initially indicted in Rapid City back in February 2017. So it's been put off for, you know, 2 years at this point.
Right. And I want to end where we started, which was this sense of this is a bigger problem than just Dr. Stanley Weber. It would be easy, perhaps, to say, well, this was a bad man who, you know, tricked people and deceived people. He was a criminal. But this is a much bigger problem at IHS. Since you began this investigation and you mentioned talking to the man who's in charge of, and I'm forgetting his name, Rear Admiral Michael
Wiyaki.
Wiyaki, yeah, you sat down with him, and he was emotional as well about not only what happened, but what the task ahead of him to sort of fix something that is so terribly broken. How big is this problem? How many, you know, other crimes could be, you know, could be ongoing right now because of the way the system is laid out?
Well, you know, in fairness to the IHS and its many providers around the country, you know, I mean, many of them are you know, completely dedicated to the task at hand and meeting the, you know, immense need that they have devoted their careers to trying to fulfill. You know, one former senior clinical, you know, person at the Indian Health Service told me, you know, put it to me this way, and I thought it was sort of apt based on what I've seen since, which is that, you know, the agency collects providers with, you know, in two groups, one who bring a sort of missionary passion to their work and others who could have been French Foreign Legionnaires, you know, where they're running away from something. Mm. And we've certainly seen a lot of both in the course of our reporting. You know, Michael Wiocki says that the priority for administrators in the agency should be to protect patients and that they shouldn't be bringing on staff who, you know, who they have any concerns or suspicions about. You know, it remains to be seen whether that's easier said than done, I think, because the agency, you know, does have a lot of slots to fill. It does operate with a high vacancy rate. And it does, you know, employ doctors, including some, you know, who we know of who are working now that would probably struggle to find jobs in private sector hospitals elsewhere in the country. Mm.
Well, are there policies that can be changed that can address this? Where does he intend to really begin? What's being done right now?
He's ordered a broad, independent investigation of what happened in the case of Dr. Weber and what policies or vulnerabilities, you know, exist or could be addressed that might, you know, further strengthen the agency's safeguards. You know, where exactly those weak points are, I'm not sure that they, you know, the agency has yet sort of committed to an opinion about. You know, I think it's clear that one of them, you know, is the staffing issues and the practice of hiring, you know, doctors despite, you know, despite concerns about them. You know, he's talked a little bit about expanding who is required to, you know, report allegations of sexual assault to make basically all employees what they call mandatory reporters. You know, they've talked about some new ways of trying to find things like medical students who might help alleviate some of the need for, you know, for providers that leads to the kinds of compromises that we're discussing. But, you know, it's a really tall order. And I think, you know, Admiral Wiocki had a lot of guts to come subject himself to an interview with us at the Pine Ridge Hospital where some of the crimes that we were talking about have allegedly transpired. Yeah. But you know, and I think that he, you know, he certainly seems to us to be committed to doing what he can to improve the service, but it's not, you know, it's not an easy task.
What's next for your team? Is this something that you'll follow into the future?
Well, I've been, you know, reporting and writing about the Indian Health Service for about 2 years now, and I don't see that the story has come to an end yet.